You are listening to Serve, Protect, Lead, a podcast from the International Association of Chiefs of Police, where you will hear from IACP leadership and police leaders across the globe sharing wisdom, insight, and perspective.
Hello, everyone. My name is Christina Fernandez, and I'm a program manager at the IACP. This is our fifth podcast on the topic of the IACP's Mass Violence Advisory Initiative, which provides police leaders with peer-to-peer assistance and resources as they navigate the unique complexities and challenges in the aftermath of a mass violence incident. Today, we'll be talking about what makes mass violence incidents different from other critical incidents and other forms of violence, and how those differences present unique challenges and considerations for law enforcement leaders in terms of response and healing. Joining me today are Chief Gregory Mullen, who recently retired as Chief of Police and Vice President of Public Safety at the Clemson University Police Department, and Chief Daniel Thompson, who is currently the Chief of Police with the Waukesha, Wisconsin Police Department. Both of these leaders have extensive experience with mass violence. Chief Mullen was previously the chief of police with the Charleston Police Department and served in that capacity during the Charleston church shooting of 2015, while Chief John Thompson led his agency through the Waukesha Christmas parade tragedy of 2021. Welcome, Chief Mullen and Chief Thompson, and thank you for taking the time to share your experiences and your insights with us today. Let's go ahead and dive in, and I'd like each of you to just take a moment to introduce yourselves and tell us what brought you here today. You both faced every chief's worst nightmare in your capacity as chief, so please take us through that day. Chief Mullen, I'll start with you.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to be a part of the podcast and talk about this very important thing of mass violence incidents. For me, my incident was a church shooting that happened on June 17th in 2015 at the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. And quite a normal day, actually, we were trying to prepare for another memorial service for a mass casualty incident that had occurred in Charleston 8 years earlier with the SOPA Superstore fire, where 9 firefighters were killed. And we were actually preparing for that memorial service when this incident occurred. So we got a phone call that there had been a shooting at a very historic African-American church in downtown Charleston, and that there were multiple fatalities and injuries. So that was the initial call. And as any chief that has been through a mass violence incident will tell you, that initial call, I think, just shocks you to the point of you go in what they in a book called You're It, they talk about going to the basement. You almost kind of freeze for a minute because you really can't believe what you're hearing. Obviously, we know that these things happen all over the place, but we never want it to happen in our cities or to our departments or to our communities. The response was, as we practice throughout law enforcement now for active shooters, the response was very quick. We had multiple agencies responding. Hundreds of responders showed up on the scene very quickly. And what I think helped us there, and we'll talk more about this as we go forward, but there was a lot of work that we had done previously with our partners around the region that had allowed us to work together, train together, communicate, build trust. And as we were showing up on that scene, everybody that I was seeing when I was arrived were people that I knew, that I had worked with, that I could trust and have confidence in. Clearly went through the whole crime scene process. One of the things I think we'll talk about more that was very important, I think, for our situation as well, was that we activated a family and friends assistance center very quickly, started to provide assistance to the families and to the survivors, and then obviously went into the normal police investigations. But multiple things overwhelmed our resources very quickly, as I'm sure that Chief Thompson is going to talk about a lot as well. But I think the biggest thing for me in terms of that incident, it was a crucible event that really changed not only our community, our department, it changed me as a leader. And we'll talk more about those things as we go through. But I think that the takeaway there is that it was an overwhelming situation that we did not have standard operating procedures or general orders or checklists that we could utilize that we had developed over years. So it's one of those things that you can certainly prepare for certain elements of it, but there's a lot of it that you cannot predict or anticipate.
Thank you for sharing that with us. And we're definitely going to touch base on a lot of the things that you just brought up. Chief Thompson, I'm going to turn it over to you. Take us through that day and give us a little bit of context for what happened.
So first of all, I want to say thank you to you for this opportunity. And Gregory, thank you for sharing. We're part of a club that we never want to be in, right? But we're here. So, and I'll talk about that is briefly, my name is Dan Thompson, currently Chief of Police for the City of Waukesha. Prior to that, I served 29 years with the City of Milwaukee. And Milwaukee was generally a busy city. When I retired from Milwaukee, I had this attitude that I survived. I survived. I'm going into a smaller community, so leaving a 2,100-person department, going to 124 sworn-person department, where the community had a country urban-type vibe to it. And I did not know that I was going into a department of community where I was on the worst day, I was going to see the best. I ended up seeing the best of the community. I saw the best in our first responders. And training plays a part, but even with all the training in the world, there's no words to express that type of event. So I'll go into how that event occurred with me. So November 21st of 2021, the Saturday before Thanksgiving was, for 58 years, was the Christmas parade event for the City of Waukesha. My daughter was supposed to be cheering in that parade, but the coach got sick, so the team did not go. So we traditionally had security like done forever, even in Milwaukee, big city, same type of security for a parade event. I knew the team had everything covered, so I was not going to attend. I remember at about 3:30, 4 o'clock, I told my wife, I'm bored. Within minutes of me saying that, I get a text, which was a 1078, which is all city assist. Shots fired. Why is that word relevant? Because the sergeant that put that on the text is such a squared away professional. As soon as I saw the type on there, I knew something was bad. Immediately get dressed, put on the clothes. I'm heading out there. And all I hear is no ambulance is available. No ambulance is available. And I remember show up on scene. I'm running this first officer and I'm like, hey, are you okay? He goes, I'm good. He was just pale. I did not know that he was an officer involved in firing shots at the suspect. That's the first officer I encountered. As I'm going through the scene, I'm seeing almost a mile long crime scene. It looked like a war zone. Because we had 73 individuals that were injured. 6 of them ended up dying as a result of this tragic incident. And I remember looking at the victims. And in my mind, coming from Milwaukee, a lot of experience in handling critical incidents when it comes to shootings and things of that nature. Looking at the victims wasn't registered with me because they did not look like shooting victims. Until one of my sergeants told me, no, it was a car that ran over all these people. And it took me a second for it to register, like, okay, this is what we have. This is what we're going to do. And that's where you can have all the policies in the world. Policy went out the window that day to do the right thing. The fire departments showed up. They conveyed 20. We and private citizens conveyed the other 60. 40-something, 50-something, whatever the number was, the rest of the victims in our personal, in our squads and personal vehicles. And it was a team effort from doing triage on the scene, watching officers and off-duty nurses and doctors and firefighters, doing CPR and creating zones for us to convey people out from the scene. I remember a nurse telling me, off-duty nurse, this is my mom here. I go, where's your car? She got the car. We took mom, put her in the car, and had them go. I know that saved lives. Is that in our policy? No, we're not supposed to be conveying injured people in vehicles, but this was not a traditional incident. And what Greg said about preparing before, I didn't know we did some training on some technology a week before this parade event, knowing that I was going to play a key role in us successfully with the command to get through it.
You both touched on preparation, and you both touched on how these incidents, the rules kind of go out the window. There are things that come up that are very difficult to plan for, prepare for, that are unexpected. So I wanted to start with just some ways in which these incidents, mass violence incidents, are different. We do a lot of training for, like you said, active shooter training, critical incident response. We kind of feel like we've got it, right? But these are a different kind of situation. So I'd like for each of you to just talk us through some of the differences, some of the things that make mass violence incidents unique in terms of how you responded, how the community responded, the needs that your officers might have had during and then in the months that followed. You know, what are some of the ways in which these incidents need to be looked at as their own unique kind of ecosystems, for lack of a better word? Chief Mullen, I'll start with you.
Well, I think that they're unique because every one of them is so different. Every one of them has characteristics that are going to be unique to the city or the community that they occur in. And I also think that because of the fact that they overwhelm your capability so quickly. I mean, I've talked to a lot of chiefs that have been involved in these types of incidents, from small departments to very large departments, and they all say the same thing. You're not going to be able to do this by yourself. You're going to have additional resources that are going to help you with this. And that's going to be at the local, state, and federal level. So that's a really critical point. And how do you integrate all of those resources together? So while you're overwhelmed, you also have to be able to bring those individuals into your community and integrate well, so that you're not creating more chaos than what's already present. Because one of the things that I think is really also unique about a mass violence incident is that there's just so many moving parts. There's so many pieces. There's so many different situations that you have to deal with. Most leaders, I think, in a normal scenario, they're dealing with a specific incident, whether that's a homicide or a robbery or some type of a critical crime. But in this particular case, you're dealing with all types of these sub situations, where you're dealing with the media, you've got the political piece, you've got the family and survivors, you've got, you know, the legal aspect. So all of these things are coming at you at one time, and it just the intensity of the incident can overwhelm you as an individual. It can overwhelm your organization. It can overwhelm your community very quickly. So I think that's one key area. And I also think that because of the fact that we unfortunately have so many of these occurring now, that there are certain things that we can, in fact, anticipate that will occur, whether that's the media's attention or the political ramifications, or the how do we structure our command and control around these incidents? How do we communicate? How do we share messaging? How do we deal with victims and survivors through family assistance and victim services? So while they're unique, I do think that there are opportunities for us now to see things that are occurring in each of them and then also address that. And then clearly one of the things that is really important, I believe, in this situation is how do we deal with our responders? How do we deal with their well-being because of the impact of the sheer, I mean, in most of these cases, you've got an actor who has gone after defenseless people for the purpose of creating fear and chaos and damaging your community. And how do you deal with that in terms of helping your officers who have basically spent their entire lives and committed to providing that safety and security for that community, because this is going to impact them very negatively. And I think that you have to have those resources in place. And as I know, Chief Thompson will talk about this in a minute, much more so than I can, but the culture of that well-being is very important in making sure that it's not just a we're responding after an event to help our people who have experienced things. How do we help them beforehand, creating resiliency and like having a personal plan for themselves, an organizational plan of how we build that resilience over time so that when they are faced with this significant crisis, do they have some tools and a plan for themselves already about how they're going to respond and get through this situation and be healthy?
Build on what you're saying, Craig, is but first the first step of being overwhelmed. Our dispatch was different than a traditional critical incident, was overwhelmed immediately to a point where we had to go what I call old school, which was bringing in an officer off the street, having them literally go through the Rolodex and start calling people at home, because at the time of our Christmas parade, it was during gun season, deer hunting. And in Wisconsin, that's a big deal. So two-thirds of all of our city workers, no matter where they worked in the city, were away from downtown area. They were out up north in the woods hunting, right? So we had to go old school and actually start going through Rolodex and calling, because it's going to be overwhelmed. Other challenges that we had is we had a perfect, terrible storm. We had, when I say that, temperature dropped from 41 degrees down to 24 degrees. Power went out in our city. We had a local hospital where a security officer heard our officer who was trying to stop the threat fire shots. They actually called a community active shooter, but the hospital heard active shooter at the hospital. So you had an active shooter event going on at the hospital. So there's all this chaos. And that's where information, that's where training, that's where relationships, all those play such a key role in getting through it. And one of the things that we always talked about is taking the second. And this is pre-event. And this was instilled through sworn and unsworn throughout the department. And what that concept is we always talk about when someone says something to you, take that first second, take a very deep breath. Don't react. Take that second, take a deep breath, and respond. Because you want to get out of the loop, and you want to actually use your logic brain. And why that is relevant and why this is so impactful for me is you never know how you influence and impact other people, right? So when this happened, I'm at the scene, and I'm talking to one of my sergeants. His first words to me is, like, how are you? His first and he's the son of a pastor, so he never swears. So I apologize. His first word to me is the F-bomb. His second thing to me was, I'm taking a second. That hit me hard because things that we take for granted that we talk about, you never know how you're going to influence people. And when we talk about relationships and being a thermostat, if we show that we genuinely care about our people, and we go in and we show courage, we show patience, that's what they're going to see. If we go in cold and we don't care, that's what department members are going to see. We go in hot, that's what they see, right? So we're the thermostat, we have to set the tone. Reason why I say that was so relevant and paid off dividends, because showing up on the scene, I actually had officers say, Chief, it's great to see you. And I actually made them feel better. And you can see that light bulb hit and they went right into work mode. They got out of the OODA loop and then into work mode. All that is because of relationships invested in, this is internally within the department. Externally, relationships with the community also is a big role in working together. So we talk about those things. Another big factor that we set up ahead of time is wellness, peer support. We actually established what's called a code blue within our department prior to this. And what the code blue concept is, a person who's in crisis can call into the department, say code blue. Before, if they had something mental going on, they say, I have a headache or something like that, right? They could actually say code blue. And the supervisor will just ask a few admin questions, but that supervisor would be the contact person with the officer calling Code Blue, where they could feel comfortable removing the stigma, saying, I'm overwhelmed mentally. So at the parade, we had grief counselors, clinicians, and chaplains inside the department before any officer arrived into the station. That was important, having that established ahead of time. And that paid off. And I will say this, where I kind of dropped the ball as a chief is I got so in tune with making sure my officers, my first responders were good. I failed to recognize myself and my other supervisors that work 18 hours that they needed to go home and they needed to take a break. Hindsight is 20/20, right? But I had to take that second. Now I know, hey, slow down. This sergeant here has been here 12 hours, 14 hours. What are we doing to give them relief? But at the time I was in it, I got myself caught up in the event. Other things too is the media is not just compared from critical to a mass. You have national media and international media. We had Scotland, we had Tokyo, we had all kinds of media from all over the world show up. So the press conferences are like so much larger. And the critiques that you get from a national element when you don't have all the facts is incredible. Other things that I wanted to talk about too, I don't know if you got this, Greg, is I made a comment at the last press conference that this was not a terrorist act, which I made a mistake. What I should have said is there's no nexus to terrorism at this time. And it wasn't. It was a criminal act, a heinous criminal act. But because of those words, we had white supremacists from all over show politicizing this. And then we have Black Lives Matter coming and wanting to start a revolution in the city. And I was inundated with so much hate mail, email coming in, where we had to create a process of, chief, don't look at this stuff, because I was getting upset looking at this stuff. And we had to create a process for that. And then you have all the stuff that's left behind that you have to create and take over a warehouse. And then you have to have set up a phone number for tips and set up a phone number for people to relocate property that was left there. And then you have the family assistance. It's just, and then you have dignitaries that want to show up. And you have to set up for that. All of it, it's just days, months, even that first year after, there's so much going on.
Well, and a couple of things I want to kind of add to as well about I believe that one of the things that chiefs and organizations can do that really benefited us during our situation is that we use daily operations to really work together, to train together. We use festivals, races, those types of things to exercise and practice that command and control structure, which is one of the things that, you know, again, when I rolled up on the scene that night, one of the things that I was really appreciative of is that the folks that were arriving on scene were really already starting to set up some structure around what we needed to do. And they were integrating with other people that we had worked with over the years. And that really helped us to try to, again, bring some order to what was occurring. And then also when we started to activate our Family Assistance Center, the relationships that we had been working and building over 7-8 years in relation to clergy and chaplains and clinicians, mental health providers, we had a plan that we had put together for that Family Assistance Center. We were able to surge those resources in very quickly. And within a few hours, we were giving support and care to those families. And for me, I believe that's one of the things that we really, really achieved because we showed people we were human. We showed them that we were not just police officers and firefighters and other emergency responders that were going through the things that we do on a daily basis, whether that's medical care or criminal investigations. But we were demonstrating that we were human and that we cared about the people that were impacted negatively in our community, and that really was an opportunity for us to wrap our arms, or I should say, have the community wrap their arms around us during that really critical time, and help us move forward in kind of a bifurcated process. One, the criminal investigation was really working well, and we had multiple departments and agencies involved in doing that, and we also had our police officers, our peer support people that were working with our own responders as well as the community. And we brought in a lot of folks that we were able to surge together to start that immediately. And the community saw that and they responded to that very well in terms of how we were working with them. Now, the other thing that I will say that I believe is unique to these situations is the fact that when we were working exclusively with our responders and with the victims and survivors of this, it very quickly became apparent that this was a community-wide suffering. There were people in our community that were really impacted negatively, and they were struggling. We needed to find resources for that group as well, and we reached out to our nonprofit partners, the United Way, and had them come in and set up some hotlines and some resources. So it really just kind of scaled from the initial response on going out even a year later, as the chief said, to when the trials were happening. Those were times we needed those mental health clinicians as well in those courtrooms and with those families as they saw things for the first time in terms of crime scene photos and other things that were not released prior to that. So that's really important. And I think all of this kind of this wellness and looking out for one another comes from a culture that you have to create within your department. And if that culture is not there, where people can pick up the phone and call a code blue, or people can say, "Hey, I'm not okay. I'm not feeling well," and not get that "suck it up" that we've all heard so many times, that you're not going to be able to take care of your folks and have the response that you want and have them grow and become more resilient as a result of their involvement in this mass violence incident. And then the second thing I'll mention that he talked about as well is that words are very important. People really are focused on what you are saying. For me, the question I was asked was, "Is this a hate crime?" right off the bat. I said, "Yes, this is a hate crime." And I prefaced it with the fact that it might not meet the criminal elements needed for a prosecution. But what else can it be when you have somebody walk into a historical Black church and kill 9 beautiful people? And I could see that recognition had a significant impact on the community, and it helped us as we went through this. I believe it gave us some benefit of the doubt with the community that we were going to do the right thing, that we were really going to make sure that we put everything we could into this investigation and into this healing process for the community. And it also allowed us, I think, to demonstrate to the community that we were all a part of this. And when we had our first press conference, it was myself and a couple of other officials and a lot of community, a lot of clergy. And I think that set the stage for this is assault on our community. This is not an assault on Mother Emanuel Church. It's not an assault on individual victims. This is assault on our entire community. And it really rallied people together, because our assailant, his goal was to start a race war. In reality, what he did was bring people together and unify our community. And that was done through not only the statements that the family made, but the reaction of the community in terms of how they came together and supported one another and would not allow hate to take over our community and make it and make it more destructive than what he had already accomplished.
And when you have a good relationship with your community, that's something you should never take for granted. And you just made me think of something real quick, Greg, was we had four victims, initially deceased victims on the scene. And we ended up having a total of six, but we stayed with the unseen victims, not because of evidence. We were not going to leave them there on that street until they were taken, because they were part of us, right? They are part of us. And this is 2.5 years. I still get choked up, but and just one other side story real quick is one of my officers took a little 8-year-old and put him in a sheriff squad and took him to the hospital. He ended up passing 2 days later, little Sparks. And his family said, you took him and carried him to the hospital. We want you to carry him into eternal life and made him a pallbearer. There are so many stories like that. And that's because of those relationships where there was no division. It was us. We were in this together. So, and the press conference, those things are important too, is we ended up having some from ProHealth. We had chaplains, community, the fire, the police, the mayor. We're showing a unified front when we did our pressers. So thank you for talking about those things.
You know, and Christine, I think what that story that the chief just talked about in terms of that staying with that little victim really kind of points to another thing that I believe that we as law enforcement and as leaders need to make sure that we are reinforcing with our people in terms of mass violence incidents, is that the small things really do matter. You know, things that we might think are not important are extremely important to that victim, family, or to the survivors. And I'll share another story, just like you did, Chief, is that we had one of our victims, her son was in the church that was killed. She lived because she just laid and faked her death on top of her 11-year-old granddaughter. But she watched her son die in that incident. And a few days later, as you can imagine, we were finishing up with our crime scene and collecting all the waste that needed to be disposed of. And a few days later, she came back to us and she said, where is my Bible? I want my Bible. That Bible connected her to her son. And that Bible had been disposed of because it obviously had a lot of bio waste on it. But one of my lieutenants and an FBI evidence technician went and in dumpster dive to get that Bible. And we recovered that Bible and we sent it off to Texas and had it cleaned. And when we got it back, we noticed that there was a bullet crease across the front part of the Bible. But when we took that Bible back and gave it to that lady, we could not have done anything more impactful for her, because that gave her something to hold on to and connected her back to her son that she would never see again. And I've talked to a lot of folks that have been through incidents like this, and they're all realizing now that there are things that people want because it helps them connect to that worst day in their lives. And we have to understand, I think, that we have to be a little more sensitive to those types of things and be aware of them. We're not obviously going to be able to save everything and take everything that somebody wants, but I know that there are situations around the country right now where they're still giving things back to people that were collected during this incident because it helps them heal. It helps them give some closure to what they went through. And as law enforcement, I think it's important for us to recognize that while we have a job to do in terms of crime scene and collecting evidence and cleaning up things, we also have the responsibility to understand how those small things can have lifetime impacts, not only on the people that are receiving that, but also from the people who are giving
so
it to
much.
I can tell you that lieutenant, she will never forget the response she got from that woman when she returned that Bible.
It's so true.
Full disclosure, I wasn't there, obviously, at either of these incidents, but just hearing your words is making me feel choked up and emotional. So thank you for the honesty and for the vulnerability and for sharing your stories and how this experience impacted you both and the community and your agencies. I want to just take a quick second to just recognize Chief Thompson, what you said about taking a second and how that can apply to everything in our lives, right? Every interaction we have, and you know, doesn't need to just be during a critical incident or a situation that's heightened emotionally. I could learn that lesson, right? So that second thing. Thank you for sharing that, because I think that's really painful.
Add to that,
yeah.
Where it really impacted me the most is I have a daughter. She's 15 now, rock star. But when she is 12, 13, she had high anxiety and ADHD. And one thing that we learned is you don't negotiate with terrorists. So I'd see her going at it with mom, and I'd go in there and try to fix it. But when I started using the second at home and not trying to be a policeman at home and actually being a father and showing empathy and not reacting but responding, holy smokes, it just changed everything. And it really validated that for me at work. So you're so right. I practice it all the time, and it's a work in progress, but it really pays dividends.
Chief Mullen, you talked about resilience and how, again, this is something that we need to build those skills, and we need to have that practice before these incidents happen so that there's tools in the toolbox to be able to cope with them. I think that's such an important point. And it's funny because I think this conversation, when we first started talking, we were thinking this is going to be about the nuts and bolts about the incident and all the specifics about the response and dispatch and all those little pieces that had to come together. But ultimately, I think this conversation has moved a lot in a beautiful way about the best in other people that this incident brought out. And I hate to say it that way, but that's kind of what the direction of the conversation went in. And so I'd like to kind of explore that a little bit more as well, because what you're both describing are moments between your officers and victims and families and the community and each other and you that really demonstrated the humanity. And again, I think that's something that as law enforcement, maybe we're not always comfortable showing or are not taught to show, but you're both talked about being very genuine and being real with your emotions and being open about who you are and how you're feeling about things. And it's okay, right? So, you know, wanted to sort of highlight that as well, because I think that that's such a critical piece of all of this is the aftermath and how we relate to the people that were affected by it.
Yeah, I think it's the foundation, really. I mean, and you can train and you can understand all the response models and the command and control and the crime scene process. I mean, you can do all those things and you can do them perfectly. But if you are not able to demonstrate your humanity and the fact that you really care about the people in your community that are impacted by this and your own officers, then those other things are not, I mean, certainly you're going to do your job, but in this type of a situation, when you're dealing with a mass violence incident and it has just shocked you your organization and your community to its core. If you can't demonstrate your vulnerabilities and your humanity and the fact that you are impacted by what you are experiencing, then it's gonna show not only in your own representation to your community and to others, but your officers are gonna feed off of that as well. They're gonna be watching the leader. And I believe from our incident, the things that we did 8 years ahead of this incident is what allowed us to effectively manage and move through it, because we were getting our officers involved in the community. We were getting them connected in different ways with children and with things that were going on. We were looking at ways to make sure that we were connected from a personal level with what was going on in our community. And then when this incident happened, a lot of the people that we had been working with during those years were the people that were either family members of this church, or that, you know, the kids that we have been working with were somehow connected with these victims and survivors that were at the church. And I had so many of my officers afterwards tell me that, okay, I now get why we've been doing all of these things to connect with the community, to build trust with the community, to be, you know, respectful of one another, because it all manifested itself during that incident. All the things that we had done ahead of time. And it goes back to that culture thing. And I know that people sometimes don't like to hear about culture, but that's what it's all about. You know, whether you're teaching your folks to take a moment or a second, or whether you're teaching them to be human, or whether you're teaching them it's okay to be emotional. You know, I got criticized because I was emotional at several of the press conferences that we had, because people were saying, well, the chief should not be emotional. Well, I believe that because I was emotional, I was human. And because I was demonstrating that I was human, it was okay for my folks to feel what they were feeling and asking for help and seeing what they could do to make themselves more resilient. Because from my perspective, you know, I didn't want my people to bounce back to where they were. I wanted them to bounce forward and grow from this experience so that they would be stronger for the next one they may have to go through, or even help them be stronger as a human being, as a police officer, as a father, mother, whatever it happens to be. But I wanted them to grow out of this situation and not just let it define them or create problems for them.
That's excellent.
So on that note, if you could give advice to a police leader who is facing a mass violence incident now, what would you tell them?
It's okay to be vulnerable. Another thing too is, I'll just give a quick story, is after the incident, now this is months, very good at helping the officers and making sure they had wellness and doing, we call mandatory neck up checkups, where we made it mandatory for the whole department to actually go see a grief counselor and talk about it. Where I dropped the ball was, I was making all the excuses where I wasn't talking to anybody because I was so busy helping others. And I remember doing a presentation in Atlanta, and we went to a cocktail hour afterwards, and all these counselors came up to me and said, okay, you did all this great stuff. Who are you talking to? I'm like, I ain't talking to anybody, right? So I ended up 9 months later talking to a chaplain, and I ended up talking about things that happened 30 years ago that I never talked about. So that's the first thing, is being a police leader, you're not alone. Build up a network of other leaders that you can actually confide in. And it doesn't have to be a critical incident. It doesn't have to be a mass casualty. Build up that network right away. If you're a new chief, look at your mentors, who chiefs that you look up to, start calling them, and actually make sure that they have your personal cell phone so they can text you and just text you, are you good? I had a whole bunch of calls from other chiefs, and that helped a lot, right? But don't try to think that you're going to solve this on your own. Don't be on an island on your own. And also, I learned this too, is when you're going through this and you have young kids, when you get home, they're still looking for dad. Even though you just went through the most traumatic thing in the world, they're still looking for dad. So when you do go home after an incident like this, be prepared that you might have a 12-year-old say, hey, dad, I want to do this, and you just don't feel like doing it. Take that second and get it done. That's actually going to help you too. And the other thing I want to talk about too is when you get close to the anniversary, is how do you recognize the tragedy? That was a big to-do at our department, is because no one wanted to be recognized. No one wanted to get any accolades for the amazing work that they did. So we brought in 189 officers from around Southeast Wisconsin that responded. And ourselves, we did a recognition night that we actually modeled from Orlando. And we gave a pin to everyone that was there. And then for some of the other things, we did more privately for the other awards. But I had to write a big memo to the department saying, we have to recognize this. We went through something together, and this incident is not going to define us. It's going to refine us. We're going to be a stronger, better department tomorrow than we were prior to this event. And message the same thing to the community, is that we are a stronger community today than we were a year ago.
Yeah, I think it's really important to make sure that you are communicating with your department and making sure that they understand that this, again, this does not define who we are. And in most cases, if you look at the responses and the situations that have occurred, it has made the departments and the community more stronger than they were beforehand because of the ability for them to build that resilience. But I think the couple of things that I would say to a chief, that one, as they think about this, because that's the thing that I would say, instead of talking to somebody that's in the incident, I would say, what are you thinking about now? Because we're in an environment that it can happen to anybody. It's not a situation where, you know, it's so isolated that it happens in big cities, it happens in small towns. It can happen to anybody. So what are you thinking about now in terms of where are your gaps? What are the things that you need to be dealing with? I mean, for us, even now, you know, I read every after action report that I can get my hands on, because I want to see if there's things that other people have identified that I can be thinking about in the event that I find myself in another one of those situations. So that is clearly one thing that I think all chiefs should be doing, is really looking at that information and trying to, you know, question themselves about, are we as ready as we can be? We can't be completely prepared, but are we ready as we can be? And then if you are in the incident yourself, I think one of the key things that I take away from that is I found myself throughout the periods of time that we were in the midst of it, that you know, I questioned myself. It's like, I got to get this right. I mean, please, you know, I said a lot of prayers. It's, you know, please don't let me mess this up. because I know we were only, you know, the department, the community, everybody was depending on, I felt like, me. So you're going to be in those situations. You're going to be in that moment throughout the incident where you question yourself. It might not be the first 3 or 4 hours, but sooner or later, you're going to find yourself in a place that you're by yourself, and you're going to question, am I doing this right? Am I doing everything I can? And am I getting it? Am I getting all the pieces put together? And just know that you're not going to have all the answers. You're not going to have all the pieces. You're not going to have all the information every time, but you got to be able to make the best decisions that you can based on your training, your experience, the trust and the confidence that you've built in your team, as well as your partners and in the community. But, you know, those things are going to happen. And I think knowing as much as you can ahead of time and how you are going to create that calm in the midst of the chaos, because the chief mentioned earlier on that your folks are looking at you, and calm is contagious. And if they see you really spun up and excited, then they're going to be really spun up and excited. So it's important for that leader to show calm, to show the fact that this is a horrible situation, and we're going to get through it, and we're going to get through it and protect our community.
And Greg, I don't know if you felt this, but I, as a chief, I felt guilt because it happened on my watch.
Absolutely.
Yep. And exactly what you said, I'm questioned, did we do everything that we could have done to prevent it? And I can honestly say now, we did everything we could have done. There's no way we could have prevented it from happening. But what we can do is really prepare ourselves for when it does happen, to bring the best.
This is a good time for us to also mention our Mass Violence Advisory Initiative, of which you are both members, because you both kind of touched on this. The Mass Violence Advisory Initiative, for our listeners, is a project where we provide police leaders who are facing a mass violence incident with one-on-one peer-to-peer support from leaders who have been through it before. And it's at no cost to the responding agency. So Chief Mullen, Chief Thompson, they're available to help kind of walk you through what you can expect and be there should you need a sounding board, should you need someone to talk through some things that are coming up. And one of the things that we always say in MVAI is you don't know what you don't know. And there are things that you're not going to know, and that's okay. That you don't have to go through it alone. There are people who are there to support and who can provide you with some guidance and some information, because these, like you said, these situations are so unique and so different. And you're not expected to know it all. And you're not expected to deal with all of it on your own, knowing that there's so many different moving parts and different considerations. So I wanted to take a moment to just mention the MVAI. And again, that Chief Thompson and Chief Mullen are members of that initiative. And we have additional members, additional chiefs, PIOs, chaplains, police psychologists, who have all been through this and who've been through an incident and are there available to provide support and assistance. So I wanted to touch on that. I wanted to thank you both for taking the time today to share your experiences with our IACP members. And thank you again for being such valued members of our Mass Violence Advisory Initiative. Your willingness to help police leaders in a way that really only someone who's walked in their shoes can is invaluable to us. And again, just thank you for your openness and your vulnerability and for sharing your stories with us, because I really do think that hearing it directly from you and what you experienced and what effect it had on each of you and your communities and your agencies is so very important. To our listeners, if you'd like to learn more about the Mass Violence Advisory Initiative, please visit our webpage at www.theiacp.org/MVAI. This concludes our podcast today. Be well.